We're here at Menards Bag Sale, asking shoppers what they're putting in the bag to get 15% off.
Paint.
Batteries.
Tools.
Toilet paper.
Extension cords. Grocery items.
Hardware for my cabinets.
Snack items. Crackers and some canned good stuff.
Shop vac supplies.
Toothpaste, cereal, coffee, dog treats. I've got a lot of stuff to grab.
The list goes on, but the sale ends January 24th. Hurry in for Menards 15% off bag sale. See store for complete details.
Save big money at Menards.
We're starting things off with a word from our sponsor. Since 1998, DVD Netflix has delivered more than 5 billion DVD and Blu-ray rentals to movie lovers in every American zip code and to military bases around the world in their famous, iconic red envelopes. With an extensive library of titles from the early 1900s to today, and shows from such premium networks as HBO and Showtime, DVD Netflix is a must for physical media lovers. Featuring a variety of different plans starting at as little as $8.99 per month, it's a great way to experience DVDs and Blu-rays with special features and commentary tracks you won't find anywhere else. A member for over 20 years, so well before I ever began working with the service, as an official blogger on acting, or as a DVD, Netflix, Twitter film discussion host, I think it's a terrific way to keep our vintage video store memories alive and support the physical media that we love so much. So be sure to check out DVD Netflix for yourself at DVD.com. Now, on with the show.
Hey, this is Jen Johans at FilmIntuition.com and FilmIntuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen.
Welcome to 2023 and Season 4, Episode 1 of Watch with Jen, which marks the 176th installment of the podcast so far. We have a stellar lineup of new and returning guests, a nice combination of some of your favorites who are all set to come back to the show, as well as voices you and I will be discovering together for the first time. I've recorded several conversations so far and have 5 more scheduled soon. And the feel of these episodes so far is looser than it has been in the past, as we're just moving freely from one film to the next. While I'm sure we will still have some very structured and more research-filled shows, including 2 on deck right now that I'm working on, I hope you will enjoy the breezier approach for the rest and want to thank you so much for tuning in. So let's kick off the year, shall we? This week, I'm honored to welcome back Ted Griffin, the terrific creator of the FX series Terriers and an outstanding screenwriter whose credits include Ravenous, Ocean's 11, and Matchstick Men, which was co-written with his brother Nicholas. Ted is additionally the producer of such Oscar-nominated films as Up in the Air and The Wolf of Wall Street, as well as the infectiously entertaining Emmy-nominated series Pretend It's a City. Ted, I want to thank you so much for being here today. How are you doing, and how is 2023 treating you so far?
Thank you for the nice intro. You managed to avoid all the credits I flinch at.
Okay, good.
Well done. I'm doing great. It's award season, which is, as we all know, the happiest time of year. So it's and I'm just getting over a cough, so in case I wheeze, don't
sinus don't, as well, so same.
All right, don't call 911.
Yes,
or do. But 2023's doing all right by me so far.
Good, I'm glad to hear it. And recently, you've had some more acting credits to your name.
The career's really taking off. For those of you out there who love my performances, Agent Hughes in Wolf of Wall Street, the FBI agent who doesn't speak, you can see me very briefly in both Poker Face's pilot, directed by my friend Ryan Johnson, and the rom-com Your Place or Mine, written and directed by Poker Face was written and directed by Ryan. Your Place or Mine was written and directed by my friend Lynn Brosh McKenna. So I'm getting cast, I'm getting pity cast in things, which is worked for me in high school and is happening again. So I got to start working on your consideration ads.
Yes. Yeah. We need those out for next award season. Yeah. Remember, Ted Griffin is what we're saying. Exactly. Yeah.
As Stevie the Doorman and Dale McClintock Gambler.
The pivotal performances of projects,
both,
for sure.
Both shows really, yeah.
Everything hinges on the doorman. That's what we're going for.
A lot of people have asked if those two characters fought, which would win. And I really like to let just the audience kind of figure out that. I don't want to.
Okay.
And one or the other.
Why ruin the fantasy of the fight between those two? Because, I mean, there's so much fan fiction that's been written about it. And we know. Yeah. Is there anything else you're working on?
Yes. But nothing to promote yet.
Okay.
I'm trying to give what I can say for myself. No, I've been in a bunker and hopefully we'll be on the floor with something. But
sounds good.
Knocking on wood on that.
Yes. Well, I was so excited to team up with you again. I had a lot of fun talking Leo McCary with you and also exchanging movie recommendation ideas via email. So I was really excited that you graciously agreed to come back. You had so many good ideas for episodes. I know we'll have a lot of fun going over some of those in the future as well. But the one that I kind of zeroed in on, I think it might have been first on your list, was writer-director Curtis Hanson, who's long been one of my favorites because Wonder Boys is one of my all-time favorite movies. And he also did, you know, the masterpiece L.A. Confidential and all kinds of other great films, including the thrillers that we're going to talk about today. But I was curious, what brought you to Curtis Hanson as your idea?
This might be a long-winded answer, so I'm just going to jump right in.
I'm cool with it. I think everyone would like it.
When I was a young screenwriter, newly in the business, in September of 1997, I was in fact in my first year of getting paid to be as a screenwriter and getting taken out to dinner by people. Mm-hmm. I was invited by a couple of Warner Brothers execs to the premiere of L.A. Confidential.
Oh, wow!
And it was one of those nights that it was sort of the perfect Hollywood night of like, this is what in your imagination of what going to a premiere will be like, this is it. I was familiar with the novel by, I'd sort of become an Elroy fan a few years before.
Okay.
so I kind of knew what I was getting into, but, and I remember back then I still took premieres seriously enough to like that I would try to dress nicely, a suit, no tie or something like that. So these execs took me to dinner at Musso and Frank's, the legendary Hollywood restaurant. And then we went down the street to the Chinese theater where the premiere was. And as we walked up to the premiere, the soundtrack was blasting. So music I'd grown up listening to, like Lee Wiley and Dean Martin, was playing. And I just sort of thought, oh, wow, this is like,
yeah, perfect.
Going to a premiere in the 40s and 50s. The movie played, and when the credits started to roll, it was that weird experience you sometimes have of like, I think I just saw a great movie.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just my opinion right now. And like most people in Hollywood, you're sort of like, I need to corroborate this. But I turned to somebody, I said, I think that might be a classic.
Yeah.
And there was this great energy. Everybody came out of the theater. And because I think Warner Brothers had sort of blown all their cash on a big event at Cannes, there was no party for the LA premiere. Mm-hmm. But people just gathered on the footprints at Grauman's Chinese and stayed there for an hour just talking. No bar. No incentive to hang out. And I sort of joined that, really not knowing that many people yet, but seeing, you know, recognizing some people from the movie. And then I was introduced to an agent named George Freeman, and he said, "You're Ted Griffin?" I said, "Yeah," like a little surprised to be known. And he grabbed me and he dragged me across to meet his client, Russell Crowe. And Russell Crowe said, oh, you're Ted Griffin. And I was like, yeah. And it was this like, you just became a movie star inside and you know who the hell I am. It was this incredibly flattering moment. He had read Ravenous and wanted to do it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, the irony is that Guy Pearce, who was somewhere else in the crowd, ended up
doing the movie
Ravenous. And which is also, and this is completely for Deep Track fans, I think I had inadvertently ripped off the beginning of Ravenous from a scene in the book LA Confidential, because Ed Exley has a bout of cowardice in World War II, for which he, which turns into like, gets rewritten as a bit of heroism. And that's how Ravenous starts. And the irony is that Guy Pearce ended up playing both Ed Exley and my lead character, John Boyd, was like, I think somebody picked up on it much later. I had forgotten the theft when we made the movie, frankly. But anyway, for anyone out there who thinks that I had a great idea for the beginning of Ravenous,
which is on the Criterion channel right now. We were talking off air about that.
We'll promote that. That Ravenous is now on the Criterion channels. Anyway, so that was my first experience with LA Confidential. And I was and have been nuts for the movie since. I rarely go a year or two without watching it. And I find it both a great movie and an extremely rewatchable comfort food movie, if that makes any sense. It straddles both categories in the same way that I would say The Godfather does for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Like, I both like enjoy it and esteem it.
That's a Christmas movie in our house. Yeah, The Godfathers. And you can kind of see that with LA Confidential for sure.
So then in 1999 or early 2000, I was set up on a meeting with Curtis Hanson. And I think by that time I had written the script for Ocean's 11. And that had sort of gotten passed around. So maybe he'd read that, except to say, but we hit it off. And he had a book that he owned that he wanted to adapt into a script. And I may not mention the title of it because
I don't
know where it's at now. But it was sort of an adventure movie, a period adventure movie in sort of, partly a little bit of David Lean, a little bit of God, who's another good example of this, but like a lot of Curtis's stuff, it kind of had a foot in classic film and then with the idea of making it feel contemporary in a way, which we'll talk about, I think, which is true of a lot of these thrillers that we're going to talk about today. Anyway, so I signed on having barely read the book, just because I thought Curtis was great.
Yes.
We spent a good deal of that year together talking about this, hanging out. He took me to a Bud Bedeker retrospective screening of, it was either Seven Men from Now or The Tall Tea or both. And there was a Q&A afterwards with Bud and Curtis. And I remember, and Bud Bedeker was pretty old and probably died maybe a year later, but it was delightful watching them together and hearing stories from Bud Bedeker. And there was a real feeling of like, Bedeker was one generation, Curtis was the next generation down. I felt like the next generation. Like, I felt like, I'm the grandson here. And anyway, I got to like Curtis very much, and we'll talk a little bit about his personality later. What didn't happen was I couldn't wrap my head around this book and the script. And I spent a long time, and I wrote 100 pages of screenplay and realized I wasn't really even halfway into the book. And I was extraordinarily frustrated with that. Ocean's 11 was about to start production in Las Vegas, and I was kind of... and I was also, even though I was just newly 30, I was probably in retrospect pretty dumb and distracted. And I basically gave the 100 pages to Curtis and said, I'm so sorry, I cannot figure this out. And I have to go to Las Vegas now to sort of watch a movie get made. And mm-hmm. so I disappointed Dad.
Oh, anyway. Too bad we couldn't clone you and you could have done both.
I looked into it at the time. anyway, so not that it ended acrimoniously, but after something like that, I just kept my distance. And a few years later, a very long story, which I'll boil down to this. I got fired off of a movie, which was pretty traumatic. And when something traumatic happens in your life, you tend to remember those people who call you up and say, hey, how you doing, man? You okay?
Yeah.
That was Curtis Hanson. And
oh, wow. That's so nice.
And he told a story about how he nearly got fired off of one of the movies we're going to talk about today and what happened. But he was a source of consolation and support. And we didn't hang out necessarily for the rest of his life, but we did see each other occasionally, and some other, I saw him some other times, which I'll get to later on. And he was, I think he was, so in a way he was like the mentor that got away.
Mm-hmm.
And I've chosen him today as sort of a mea culpa for screwing that one up.
Well, we're honoring him.
And we're honoring him because I also, like Leo McCarey, think he's a really terrific filmmaker who had an interesting kind of bifurcated career between being a genre director who was sort of a journeyman. And I think he would be proud of that statement. I think he considered himself a craftsman, not an auteur. Mm-hmm. And then he managed to make, in my mind, a masterpiece and a miracle of Hollywood craftsmanship, in a way LA Confidential shouldn't be as good, or he shouldn't have gotten away with that movie, and it somehow through skill and luck did. And then the second half of his career, which we won't talk about today, is sort of his moment of being able to explore all the other genres and do things on a certain level that he wasn't allowed in the first half of his career. For those who don't know, he died too young. He died at 71 from FDT, which I'll pronounce in a second, but it's basically the same thing that Bruce Willis has now. It's a sort of dementia in which you're not aware that you have it, which is
very cruel,
extremely mm-hmm. cruel, especially to all the people around you, because he was kept wanting to go back to the set.
Yeah.
Even when he was completely incapable. So,
I worked in a nursing home and volunteered. And so I dealt with some seniors who had similar issues, and they were always like thinking that they were needed back on the farm to do chores or whatever it was. And yeah, it was very hard. Cruel disease.
Anyway, so with, so then I'll said, that's why I want to talk about Curtis Hanson.
Yes.
And I do want to talk a little bit about his biography, but so that I'm not that long-winded, we can, if you want, we can sort of talk about a movie, and then I can like jump back in time and say what led up to Silent Partner, or what his youth was like.
Yes, I was fascinated learning more about him because I always loved his work. I remember seeing The River Wild with my older brother and his friends. And that was the first one I really went as a big group with. And we had so much fun. They were the group that I saw basically all the movies with in the 90s. And so it kind of started with The River Wild. So I love that. I knew who Curtis Hanson was by the time I got to LA Confidential because of it. But looking back at his career, I wasn't sure where it began. He was a high school dropout, a surf bum who became like a film writer, a critic, and an editor and a photographer. And that was his first experience with a film camera, I found doing a little bit of research. But I love how much he was just passionate about movies, which was so cool. There were stories about him going to all those rep screenings, like you talked about with the Butterker Westerns, which is so cool. And UCLA Film and Television Archive made him their first ever honorary chairman, which I thought was, you know, very fitting for Curtis. He's somebody who talks very passionately about watching Vertigo as a child, and also the films of Sam Fuller, who was one of his mentors. And then, you know, there's that great group of filmmakers in the era that kind of had their or cut their teeth at American International Pictures, Roger Corman. And so that was one of his experiences as well. There's some funny stories about like Peter Fonda leaving a car with a nasty message on Dunwich Horror, which was like one of the films he first made when Peter Fonda got Easy Rider. So there's a lot of great stories about his career or what led up to it that I was totally new to in researching this. So I want to thank you for inspiring me to do that. But looking at these movies, even you know, the ones like Wonder Boys and In Her Shoes and 8 Mile, the films that came after LA Confidential, there is sort of a running theme that goes through them. And he has acknowledged it as well, as it's people who are constantly in search of their better selves, or people trying to find what's next. And I think that kind of comes from that sort of beginning of being a high school dropout and searching for the next thing and knowing there's more than that, and continuing to go for it. Yeah.
Having known him, it's strange looking back, especially at these 5 movies, and thinking about him. If you can, I'm sure listening in, you can Google him and bring up a picture. At the time, I described him as being like Harry Shearer's taller, thinner brother. And who sounded a little bit, and I didn't say this at the time because it wasn't, but that he sounded like David Lynch doing a John Ford impression. I can't really do a Curtis, but it was always like there's a certain timbre, and which is strange. So he was, and then watching these movies, I realized, oh, a couple of times, like David Strathairn is Curtis's, like the movie version of Curtis. Like,
oh, that's interesting.
Tall, has a certain look, and also a little tough to read. Like, Curtis was, I find, a very internal guy, very friendly, very nice, very funny, but not an extrovert, not an easy read. And also, as a film director, I think, and probably this, I imagine, may have held him back early in his career. Not a guy with a lot of like sheen, not a salesman. He was a very authentic guy.
Yeah.
But if you think of a guy, if you're an executive and this guy walks into your office pitching a movie, you know, generally studio execs don't think that much of cinephiles. They like guys who are going to be, who are going to make them lucky, or who are going to make them money and who are lucky. And, but Curtis had great reverence for classic Hollywood, which I think is reflected in his movies.
Yes.
And I have a feeling like that almost that sincerity and that reverence probably hurt him to like getting going.
That's true.
I'm going to tell a little bit of his bio just leading up to
Silent Partner.
Because I didn't know he's very much a Los Angelino in the same way that Robert Town is. Like, not, he doesn't scream Californian in it doesn't look like a surfer, but he spent a lot of time. Curtis grew up in the Valley, apparently not too far from James Ellroy around the same time.
That's what I heard. Yeah.
But it's been a predominant amount of his adulthood living in Venice. And there is something kind of beachy about him. But that is nothing like, I guess, what you would imagine, your popular imagination of like being beachy, being blonde hair in a convertible. Mm-hmm. But he was born in Reno, Nevada, for the very peculiar reason that his father was a conscientious objector in World War II and mm-hmm. was sent there as to a labor camp, which I didn't quite know existed. And so Curtis's dad and mom were living in Reno with their young child when Curtis was conceived and born. And so so he's a native Nevadan, but really a Los Angelino. And he grew up in, I think, largely in Reseda, I think. But his father was an extraordinarily popular public high school English teacher. And so I think Curtis was raised as a reader, as a, and a book lover, mm-hmm. But not necessarily as a spectacular student. He did drop out of high school. Then he got his GRE and went to Middlebury for, I think, a year. There are a couple of conflicting reasons about why he dropped out of Middlebury. One was because after Kennedy was shot, that he disagreed with the university policy about how much time they that they didn't cancel classes. Another one was that he just wanted to be the film critic for the newspaper, and they only allowed juniors and seniors to do that. And he said, screw it. So he left. So he was always, I think in a way like impatient to find that next thing. And he came back to LA, and his uncle, Uncle Jack Hansen, was kind of the successful brother, and he owned a club, a really famous club at the time called the Daisy, which was where the Rat Pack hung out in Beverly Hills. Rat Pack hung out there, but sort of the Hollywood jet set were hung out there a lot. So Curtis, I think, started parking cars there or working there. Uncle Jack also had bought a magazine called Cinema.
Yes.
It was the sort of LA's answer to Cahiers de Cinema, or what's the New York one that sort of Bogdanovich and other people wrote for? I can't remember.
I'm blanking on it as well.
But in a way, Curtis started working on that for free and quickly writing and doing interviews and photography, and I think quickly moved up to being its editor. But that gave him access to a lot of people. And so he was interviewing John Ford and some of his heroes.
Yes.
And I didn't know this until this past week, that Warren Beatty came to him and said, kid, I need you. There's this actress I want to cast in my next movie, but I need photographs of her. Can you do this for me? So Curtis Hanson took Faye Dunaway to the beach and took photographs of her, which are stunning. And
wow.
Warren Beatty sell her to Warner Brothers for Bonnie and Clyde. And in return, Curtis said, I don't want to be paid, but I do want to be able to come to the set of Bonnie and Clyde and watch and interview you. So he ended up getting an article out of it. But
nice.
There's a bit of Forrest Gump, or sorry, of Forrest Gump in Curtis, in that he's on the set of Bonnie and Clyde. And
yeah.
One thing I also discovered about Curtis is that he was roommates and pals in the late 60s with Willard Huck, or Huck. I wish I could pronounce that correctly. Co-writer with Gloria Katz of American Graffiti and Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. Anyway, the story goes that Curtis is actually the inspiration for the Richard Dreyfuss character in American Graffiti. So there's that.
And later on, this one's kind of crazy, but his first wife, a woman named Catherine Wooten, was the script supervisor on The Twilight Zone. So she came home from work one night at 5 a.m. saying there was an accident on set. So she was there for the Vic Morrow helicopter.
Oh, wow.
There's just like there's weird things that come into Curtis's life. But getting back to the narrative, he is, I think, as you said, he kind of crosses paths with Roger Corman. I think that's his first writing gig. Have you seen this movie, by the way?
Don't Horror? No.
Yeah, I've not been able to find that, Sweet Kill, or Little Dragons, which are sort of his first low budget swings writing. And then he wrote and directed a movie for Roger Corman called Sweet Kill, which I believe was originally called The Arousers.
Because
it was just, Roger Corman wanted Tab Hunter and a bunch of naked gals on a poster. And Curtis delivered that somehow. He made a TV movie. I can't remember what year that was, so I might be jumping ahead of myself, about the Children of Times Square. But basically,
that's in the 80s. But yeah,
that's from the 80s. OK, because that's actually his first movie with Bob Elswit, who is.
Oh, cool.
The legendary
cinematographer. Yeah.
Director of photography, who is also one of his best friends. And I'll get to Bob in a second. Sorry if I'm being sporadic and jumping all over the place.
Oh, no, I love it. Yeah.
But ultimately he got his hands on this book, a Danish book called Think of a Number, and wrote it on spec, it was retitled Silent Partner, and took it to a producer who was friends with, named Joel Michaels, and they managed to make it in Canada. But the problem is the deal with, to get the Canadian financing, the state financing, is they basically needed most of the major participants Canada. To be Canadian. And Elliot Gould was an American, so he was one of their exceptions. But Christopher Plummer was Canadian, and I think Susanna York, by being a member of the Commonwealth, was given the okay. So they shot this movie, which was, I think Curtis had originally set in Minnesota, takes place in Toronto now.
Oh, wow.
Which is why a pre-SCTV John Candy is in the movie.
And very good, yeah.
But Curtis couldn't direct it. They had to get a Canadian, and they got this guy.
Daryl Duke.
Dylan Duke. Daryl Duke. I kept on saying David Duke, which is the worst mistake. Daryl Duke, who had done Paycheck, which has an excellent
rip. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And but I think part of the Curtis's deal was he had to be around. What happened, I'm told by fairly reliable sources, is that once Daryl Duke delivered his director's cut, he said, I'm out of here, and had other stuff to go do. So Curtis ended up sort of taking over it in post and cutting the movie, and then did 3 or 4 days of reshoots. And so I consider it very much a Curtis Hanson movie. It has his fingerprints all over it. But I do know that even when I knew Curtis back in 2000, that he was chomping at the bit to remake it. And what I don't know is if there was something that he was dissatisfied with. As certainly I've written scripts for movies that I would love to redo. I do know that he had a lot of ideas of how to update it, but I don't know what his dissatisfaction with it is. That all said, I still think it's a spectacular movie.
It's a knockout. Yeah, absolutely.
And it was a movie I remember growing up and hearing about and not being able to get back in the days when some things were difficult to find. Like you couldn't see Sorcerer, the William Friedkin movie. You couldn't find Elaine Mays and New Leaf. Famously, the Manchurian Candidate was under lock and key. Now the only thing you can't get is Jerry Lewis's Day the Clown Cried. We have 5 years left of waiting on that. Anyway, so let's talk about the movie so I can stop talking about Curtis for a second. How did you come to it?
You know, it was a few years ago. I loved it. I think I probably saw it on TCM originally, and my buddy Travis Woods chose it for my pandemic movie club. It's kind of funny. Curtis was a director. We chose a few films from. I chose The Bedroom Window 1 week when it was my turn. And Jordan Harper, our friend, chose LA Confidential because he adapted Elroy's book and he loves the film. For the TV series that was going to be made at CBS, he made a pilot with Walton Goggins. It was excellent. It was just honored at like the Austin TV Festival a few years ago. So more people got a chance to see it. But yeah, Silent Partner was one I loved seeing. It's very Hitchcockian, which is a Curtis signature. He loves Hitchcock. I read that Elliot Gould years later, or he claimed, there's been some pushback on was this real or not, but Gould tells the story that he showed it to Hitchcock and Hitchcock loved it. And Curtis, I guess, was annoyed by that. He said, that prick didn't even invite me over, because he loved Hitchcock. But as soon as he heard Hitchcock loved the movie, he was okay with it, but he still wished he could have met him. And, you know, I think sometimes the tonal shifts get a little bit of pushback. There's been some stories about the making of the movie, Daryl Duke objecting to some of the violence, like the beheading. Some of it is a little extreme and a little pushed from the tone of the film. I think there are some swings that they said Curtis, maybe for his background with Roger Corman, was more willing to do for the studio and the financiers. I'm not sure on the, you know, veracity of those claims, but I think it's great. I think Gould is fabulous. Christopher Plummer, though, I mean, what he does with his eyes and just how twisted he is. For those who haven't seen the movie, he's playing a Santa Claus bank robber, who we find out is a wild misogynist. Later, he is dressed in drag. He is all kinds of twisted in this movie, and he's brilliant. Yeah,
he sort of one-ups the classic Hitchcock sexually suspect villain.
Yes, like, yeah.
Like, you look back on Strangers on a Train, like Robert Walker, and you're not sure if Bruno is straight or gay or what, or mm-hmm. Norman Bates. Plummer is like pansexual craziness. It took a few viewings until I realized he's wearing fake eyelashes long before he gets up and
yes,
drag.
He is
mm-hmm. somewhere in the middle of the movie. He comes back he's an extraordinary villain. And
yes,
and now another personal remembrance from Ted Griffin. Speaking of getting like having one-line roles, nearly 20 years ago, I got again pity cast in a movie called Must Love Dogs.
Diane Lane, John Cusack.
Exactly. And people I knew were making it. And there was a one-line role of Diane Lane's brother, who was also happened to be Christopher Plummer's son. And they just thought, let's get Ted to play it. And so they cast me, not even an audition.
Look at you.
Written and directed by the very
offer
sweet,
only. Yep.
I am offer only. A very sweet man, Gary David Goldberg, creator of Family Ties, co-wrote and directed it. And so I'm there one day, like waiting beside Christopher Plummer. And I know well enough, like, don't mention Sound and Music. And
don't be that guy. Yeah.
But it's still Silent Partner is still sort of a deep enough cut that I think, oh, I'll impress him by being.
Mm-hmm.
And so I say this something like, I rewatched Silent Partner last week, and God, you look terrific in that dress. I make that kind of joke, and he just looks at me in a complete, don't ever speak to me again. And I didn't. I just stayed the hell away. So I don't know how Chris Plummer felt about. That movie versus Captain Von Trapp, but he's very, very good in it. And
yes.
And Elliot Gould is, while he does not look like Curtis at all, there is something Hansonian about him in that he's a very
Hansonian. I like this. Yes.
Enigmatic protagonist at the beginning. Like part of his character is nobody can quite figure him out. Does he like Suzanne York? Doesn't know whether like there's something going on with him. What he's a collector of fish. He's just sort of
kind of a loner
guy.
Yeah.
And And also, I guess it should be mentioned that the beginning of the movie is very much like The Apartment in a way, in that it's this, the gal he kind of likes is having an affair with the boss, and he's got to take her to the Christmas party. And
he's the beard.
And the movie really does a very good job of getting right out of the gate, setting that up, setting up the plumber bank robbery, and getting to Gould's plan of sort of stealing from the thief, which begets this cat and mouse thing. And I generally would invite everybody to see the movie instead of listening to us talk about it. I did learn that the third act of the book has absolutely nothing to do with the movie, that Curtis really did create that. I don't know if that necessarily involves the introduction of, and I can't remember the actress's name, but basically like the woman who introduces herself to Elliot Gould as being his father's nurse, but is really a agent of Chris Plummer. I don't think that's an invention of Curtis's. It might be. What I do know is sort of the whole final bank robbery, third act twist is not from the book at all, which I believe was adapted prior to Silent Partner into a Danish film, which I have not been able to find.
I guess it was made twice, and I don't know either one. Yeah.
What else to say about Silent Partner? Yeah, there are moments where it does not need to be quite as violent, because it's very much a classic Hitchcockian thriller in a way, with a contemporary, morality and sense of humor. Mm-hmm. With some egregious nudity,
exploitative, gratuitous nudity. Yeah,
don't need Susanna York's
no
breasts on display in that scene. And I think I showed it to my wife, and she hated it because she just thought it was a really brutal, mean movie. Where I think it's a hoot. I'm sorry, Curtis never got to remake it. I'd be curious. But I'm very happy interesting. With what it is.
Yes, absolutely. Well, his next film that he wrote and directed is another one based on a novel, The Bedroom Window, which I read that he had wanted to do 15 years earlier. It took a long time for him to get this one made as writer-director. I think Silent Partner, he was hoping to direct originally. This kind of helped put him on his path into making these genre experiments, these Hitchcockian movies. The Bedroom Window, I think, is terrific. It has Steve Guttenberg. I mean, it's an erotic thriller with Steve Guttenberg. Welcome to 1987. But Dino De Laurentiis thought he was, a box office get because he was very popular in comedies. Yeah. I think he's great, actually, in this. It's an against type performance, but he's really good. Elizabeth McGovern is great. Isabelle Huppert adds something extra, which is what I read Curtis wanted in her role, because she is a good contrast for Elizabeth McGovern. He said Elizabeth McGovern was the only choice for him, and so she was the one going in he knew he needed for this. So I've always liked The Bedroom Window. It's twisty. What are your thoughts on this one?
Lots of thoughts. I remember seeing this in a theater two or three times, and I was 16.
Okay.
Where to start? First of all, I'll start by saying he actually gets a directing gig after Silent Partner, before Bedroom Window, which is a movie titled Tijuana and then got retitled Losing
It. That's right.
Which in the race of the race to the bottom between that and Porky's, it lost. It's a bunch of kids go to lose their virginity and south of the border, and all hell breaks loose. And it's notable for Shelley Long and for a very young Tom Cruise and a good John Stockwell and Haley, not Haley Joel Osment, Jackie Earle Haley. It's not great. They had I think it was a good learning experience for him. He had to, like, they were shooting nights in, I'm going to get the wrong name of the town wrong, but a town right on the Mexican border. But it was not successful. And so it, in a way, I think there's in Curtis at the already at the time is an inclination to do a many different things, not just thrillers. He also does a draft of Never Cry Wolf, which is a terrific
Carol Ballard. Yes.
And so he's capable of different things, but
and he had that White Dog experience. White earlier. Dog was helpful. Yep.
But this becomes right at like his pathway to the chair is making and I think he becomes known as a genre director.
Yes.
For the first time in his career because this is where he can get the gig. And the movie's book on a book called The Witnesses by I want to say Ann Holden. Let me look it up. Make it up. Ann Holden. Yeah. Which was written in 71. So yeah, he was probably tracking it for a while. This time watching it, I was struck by a couple things. One is how many good actors he has in small roles, like Maureen Chaykin or
Wallace Shawn. Yes.
Wallace Shawn is I mean, that's a great scene.
Yes.
Margolis as guy in phone booth. Yeah, if you're a fan of Scarface, you probably like this movie because Margolis and is it Paul Chenard? I don't want to get the name wrong, as Isabelle Huppert's husband, are both veterans of De Palma's Scarface. So I think he has terrific actors in there. It is one of those movies that, as I watch it, I always think, if this movie had been in black and white and made 20 years earlier, it would probably be a classic.
For sure. Yeah.
It would certainly have a better reputation than it does. There's something, the trappings of the 80s, and I think Gutenberg's quite good in this movie. Like,
yes, I agree.
His Labrador enthusiasm really kind of works. And when
he has a little humor that you need, yeah, like a little bit of Hitchcock humor, because otherwise it could be like a Sam Fuller movie, essentially. Yeah.
I thought I'd describe him as a Bob Cummings, like meaning Bob Cummings really had no dark side.
Yeah.
As opposed to Jimmy Stewart or Cary Grant, where you think like, okay, there's a little bit of.
Yes.
So yes, I think it was done 20 years earlier. There's also something in watching old movies where you have a suspension of disbelief because you think like, well, in the 50s, what did people know? Which was probably they knew a lot more than we think they did. But because I think the first half of the movie, the character actions are very pretty solid.
Once very logical. Gets a little convoluted. Yeah.
That he would go and tail the suspected killer, or that he would let Elizabeth McGovern like be bait for that. Thing is like is a little creaky when you think about it in reality, but if you put it in the past, it's sort of like, well, yeah, sure, why not? I think you're more willing to go with that. You're more willing to let like Grace Kelly go into Lars Thorwald's apartment and check things out.
It's very rear window.
Character names with actresses names there. To some degree I think it suffers from its 1980s-ness. The two things that came to mind watching this time also was that because De Laurentiis produced it, I think they had some operation in North Carolina, which is why Blue Velvet was shot in Wilmington. And I kind of like in a way now those movies are mixed for like are a DVD two pack for me, even though they're wildly different. And Curtis did share with me when I got fired that he was almost fired off of this movie because De Laurentiis had foisted a Italian director of photography on him who spoke no English. And the first 2 weeks were a disaster. Like they were just way behind schedule. And Dino said, I'm going to fire you. And Curtis said, like, you can't, like, this is the problem. Like, give me somebody I can communicate with. And then he got that, and the ship was righted. The other thing that just, this is an Aaron comment, but because I'm a fan of The Wire, for some reason, because this bedroom window is set in Baltimore, I just started thinking, like, if you did a mash of, like, McNulty being the cop that is investigating this, or they're two very different Baltimores. Like, it's the bedroom window of Baltimore is this place where, like, one rapist murderer seems to be on, like, a high priority for everybody, whereas Baltimore
in real life, like,
oh, just everything sucks. There's nothing to do about that. But I just kind of, I can imagine all those people living in the same universe. It's maybe it was funnier in my head. So yes,
you like Laura Lippman novels. She, you know, lives in Baltimore and kind of writes genre work. This would be that kind of thing too, but yeah.
So this does, I think, pretty well. Not gangbusters, but it he's on solid ground from this as a director. Does better than Losing It. which brings us to Bad Influence, which I think you know more about than I do. So I will kind of hand over Bad Influence to you.
Yes, I wrote an essay on Bad Influence a few years ago. Now it's my turn to tell a personal story. I wrote an essay that was getting kind of burned out writing film reviews. And so just to, like, you know, exercise the creative muscle, I wrote an essay on this. And also I love writing about James Spader. My thesis was actually on Sex, Lies, and Videotape, and I got a scholarship for it. So there's something about the Spader protagonist and in this era, the yuppie weirdness that fascinates me. So I loved writing about Bad Influence. But afterwards, some reader, and I still don't know who, tracked down my business address, which isn't terribly hard to find because it was registered as an LLC when I did events years ago, and sent me a DVD of Bad Influence and Masquerade, which are two with Rob Lowe. And just, it was, there was no address, anything, just that, I hope you write about Masquerade too, was the note. And so for the longest time, my friends, the joke was it was either from the biggest Rob Lowe super fan in, like, the world, or it was from Rob Lowe. So yes, Rob Lowe, this is really his movie. I think he is remarkable as the villain. He didn't want to play it. He was falling into that post-Brat Pack thing of trying to be likable. A lot of actors, you know, you want to get work and you want to be likable. And it was David Koepp who wrote the script, who took him out to lunch and, like, told him, you have to play the villain. Like, this is you. And it was a difficult shoot for Rob Lowe. This was around the time of the sex scandal at the DNC, like, all of that broke. But years later, there was an interview Lowe did in about 2017. He talked about thinking this movie isn't dated. It was ahead of its time, and he's really proud to have been in it and thinks it's still very good. So he was really proud of this one. Spader loved it too. I think there are some problems with this, sort of like bedroom window gets a little too convoluted and strange in the last act, where you do have to kind of check your brain. This one as well, like the denouement kind of comes out of nowhere. But I have a lot of affection for this movie. I think it's very cool. There's a lot of great Bob Elswit cinematography. There's that Instagram account, you know, like, is it Cocaine 80s or Cocaine Decor? This would be that movie. There's a lot of glass surfaces, a lot of mirrors, frames within frames. It's just a gorgeous looking film. And I think it's a lot of fun. Yeah. Campy. Yeah.
It is the first of a trilogy of movies he makes with Bob Elswit, who was, I will not say they were roommates, but they were very close. Elswit actually credits Curtis with being kind of his film mentor, that when they were starting out, Curtis dragged Bob around town, LA, to all the revival theaters that were still going when the New Art was Revival Theater, when the Rialto was. And so he got his film education from Curtis. He also tells the story about like breaking his foot and having to miss out on a gig. And basically Curtis let him stay at his place and nursed him for 6 months.
Oh, wow.
Like, there are a lot of stories. I'll take a quick break from the movie to say of Curtis kind of going out of his way. He was one of the few guys, I think, who went and visited Robert Downey in prison.
Wow.
After
that's
one
amazing.
Boys. And by the way, I think Robert Downey was at the time uninsurable on Wonder Boys.
He was. He couldn't even get like a credit card in his name. Yeah.
And when Robert Downey Jr. got out of prison, mm-hmm. who gave him a place to live for 6 months.
Oh, Curtis. Wow. That's wonderful. So
there are a lot of sort of unseen, uncredited acts of humanity by Curtis Hanson out there. I found the movie interesting this time because the Spader role is, again, there's something that there's a Curtis quality in that, like, he's as a guy is a little tough to read, but it's also it's the and as a theme, it's kind of the beta male.
Yeah.
Both getting attracted to his dark side. I mean, the Rob Lowe character is a precursor to Tyler Durden.
In Fight Club. Yeah. Tyler Durden. Yeah.
And so there, I think there are always questions of like in these thrillers of, okay, who do you trust?
Yeah.
And that each of these characters aren't sure of the major secondary character, but also sort of like, what am I becoming?
Yes. It's like strangers on a train a little bit, but on a beach. Yeah.
And because in Strangers on a Train, which is a wonderful movie, Farley Granger never really puts his hand too close to the flame of being a killer, of father.
No,
killer.
But Spader does.
But Spader does. And I think I read somewhere that Kep admitted to copping the wrap up the dead girl and put her in a carpet that he copped it from Silent Partner when Elliot Gould has to dispose of a body.
Yeah, that's interesting. I didn't catch that this time. I was thinking about Psycho and how we're rooting for Norman Bates just like you're rooting for Spader and you're like, what am I doing? Yes.
I didn't look this up. Did Lisa Zane do a lot after this? Sister of Billy Zane, who's sort of the...
I don't know either, actually.
Because she certainly makes a mark here, but then Marcia Cross is the one who ends up with more of a career. I'm trying to think if there's any... I do remember when this movie came out in 1990 and I was 1920, having a film snob reaction to the marquee, and I don't know if that was because of Rob Lowe and the
probably.
Sex tape that I sort of thought, oh, that's like a I didn't go see it. I didn't see it for years.
I didn't see it either for years,
and that did hurt the movie. It didn't do fantastically well because of that. But I think somehow that stuck in my mind. When I first read that Curtis was doing LA Confidential, I sort of thought, oh, he's just, they got some hack. And so when I did see LA Confidential for the first time, I went, Jesus, I didn't anticipate that. I shouldn't bring up, but it was that like that youthful film snob thing that takes over.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which sort of leads into Hand the Rocks to Cradle, because he's now in these three movies. He is a director for hire.
Yeah.
He writes Silent Partner and Bedroom Window. That influences by Kep. Hand the Rocks to Cradle is written by Amanda Silver.
Yeah, it was her film school thesis. Yeah.
A huge career since, and is... mm-hmm. Now written, what's Avatar 2 is now the third or second biggest movie of all time. She has a credit on that and some of the Planet of the Apes and
Yes.
Husband, Robert Jaffa. I really should have all these names at the ready.
That's okay.
Point is, she writes this movie, Curtis directs it, and it's a massive hit. It's like all the movies he's done, Bad Influence was done pretty cheaply. Bedroom Window 2, this movie is done for a real price by Touchstone, but is a massive success for him, and is, I think, responsible for him being able to make Confidential in a few years. Like, without the success of Hand That Rocks the Cradle, L.A. Confidential doesn't exist. So, and in rewatching it, it really, for me, works.
Yeah.
Especially because I have a child, and I watched it with our nanny just because I wanted that experience. And it is, again, who do you trust? Who do you let into your life?
Yeah, it's so scary. Yeah.
And what I like about, I guess, my big comment about this movie is they're sort of at that period of thrillers right then, include Fatal Attraction is a mm-hmm. big hit. Scorsese does Cape Fear, and Basic Instinct by
Verhoeven.
And I would, and what I think is unique about Curtis's movie is that he's not making himself the star. He is not.
No,
there's not a heavy imprint of style. He is, as he says in his LA Confidential commentary, he's really focused on characters and emotions. And he's not stylizing it. He's not putting himself in the movie the way you would say De Palma does, pretty egregiously and sometimes very enjoyably. I mean, that's why
that's his fear mm-hmm.
is because of the fun of watching Scorsese go to town with this. And that's also probably why Curtis isn't, like, his name isn't bandied about, but because he is to some degree an invisible filmmaker, you could watch this and most of his movies and not say and recognize that it's the same guy in the same way that maybe who else is like that.
I've got another one coming up, George Stevens with James Urbaniak. We're going to take a look at that's another filmmaker who's worked in a lot of genres movies. And
even Billy Wilder did a bunch of genres. I still can kind of sniff out a Billy
Wilder. Yes, yeah, I think because he also wrote the films
William Wyler, Best Years of Our Lives, and Roman Holiday and Ben-Hur are all you
very
wouldn't
good.
Know.
Yeah.
I do. What did
I also say? Think with this, you mentioned the other thrillers, and I think one thing that sets this film apart is the script by Amanda Silver. We have a woman writing about women. Curtis Hanson has always, I think, been extremely sensitive when it comes to women. You can tell he likes women. The female characters have full lives in all of his films, even if they're, you know, small roles. The women are very interesting and proactive. And he talks about when it comes to this movie, it has like the creepiest opening sequence ever set in a gynecologist's office, which, you know, he said only a woman would write that. But as a man, he'd been told by girlfriends and people like stories about going to the office and creepy things that happened. So he went with his girlfriend. And the guy made a creepy joke about, oh, your boyfriend is here, so I'm going to, you know, put gloves on today. And Curtis said that always stayed with him and came, you know, when it came time to shoot, he decided to do that because, like, you know, they make weird jokes. And so he wanted to make sure that he was making things very authentic. I mean, you know, it's Rebecca De Mornay doing camp. And she has a lot of fun with it. But Annabella Sciorra is excellent. Julianne Moore has a really good scene-stealing, supporting performance in places.
In what I would call the Scatman Crothers role of the person who's comes to save the day.
Figures it out. Yes.
Bratt takes over in River Wild. And
yes.
There's some other example of
Ranger
like,
Johnny. Yes, Benjamin Bratt.
but I would say, because the Julianne Moore role, and I credit her performance, but also it's the part that you could see being a caricature of, like, she's like
the career woman version. Yes, yeah. Exactly.
She's the ambitious, but there's a absolutely a person in the Julianne Moore role. There's absolutely a person in the Rebecca De Mornay role, as much as she's doing camp.
Oh, yes.
So there's some empathy.
Feel for her earlier and, you know, stuff. I mean, we see things that you usually don't see with a villain. Like you definitely don't get that kind of point of view happening in Fatal Attraction. And we get it here. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think you can see, even though she may be homicidally deluded, but you can understand how she believes that she would be a better mother and wife in this family. Because she's been doing a better job at it. and I would say, I mean, I was trying to figure out also, like, the Ernie Hudson role, if that is something that, how dated that would feel today, or like if it's, I think it's a fairly sensitively performed and portrayed depiction of whatever our current term is for special needs. But he is, in a way, the heart of the movie. I mean, I
know. From the minute he walks on the screen, you're just, yes.
I hate De Mornay by the end of that movie, and I want her dead because of how the way she treats him.
Yeah.
Much more than the family.
Horrible.
And I think there's something very smart in that. So that movie does spectacularly well.
Yeah, number one for several weeks. Mm-hmm.
And he does. So River Wild comes along, which is, again, a script by... is it Dennis O'Dell, or is that, I had it all written down once. Anyway, Dennis O'Neill, sorry. Who I think was a newbie writer, and I think had some river rafting experience. It is, and Curtis gets more money to do it along with an AA level star in Meryl Streep.
Oh, yes.
I heard that Universal had kicked the tires on Demi Moore, but I think that was predates
Curtis. I mean,
Demi
is great, but Meryl.
But I remember that was the sort of the selling point of this, of watch Meryl Streep in this sort of movie.
Yeah.
She was, I think at the time, Meryl Streep was pushing boundaries. Like, she had done She Devil, she had done Death Becomes Her. So she was getting out of her
prestige costume drama era. Yes.
Yeah. What's my big point on this? And the movie does well, not spectacularly well, but it does well. But also, I think in rewatching it, I find it like a remarkable technical achievement, simply because it's, especially when you think about it in the pre-CGI days, that all the river rafting sequences are done pretty
well.
It is not Deliverance. It doesn't, I think, as a movie, kind of get under your skin. It is The Desperate Hours on a River. It really is.
That's a good
melodrama,
way to describe it.
But not necessarily anything that sticks with you. And so I view it as like something that Curtis cut his teeth on as a craftsman, of being able, because it moves pretty well.
It does. The ensemble is so great. I think, again, just like Hand That Rocks the Cradle, all the films that we've discussed, he works with actors so well. He said part of that was if they ask him a question and he didn't know the answer, he wouldn't lie. He would just straight up tell them, because he said, if you show that you have no fear to, you know, look a fool or whatever, then actors respond to that. Speaking of actors, mutual friend Donald Logue, I talked to recently, him and his son, and he was telling me he auditioned for River Wild 7 times for the John C. Reilly role. And John C. Reilly, of course, went out. He's a good friend of his. But he said he was told that they were shooting in places so remote in Southern Oregon, which is actually where Donald has a place right now, that they could only get there by boat. That's how remote that they were going to take this thing. And so Meryl Streep just had to go right along with it. She did a lot of her stunts. She almost drowned in one sequence. It was at the end of a day where she said she told Curtis like she was tired. They pushed again. And then afterwards, when they actually had to rush in and get her, she said, you know, if I tell you I'm tired at the end of the day, I'm tired, because, you know, Meryl is going to give 110%. But I think Kevin Bacon is extraordinary here. I love it when Kevin Bacon plays bad. I think it's really fun, just like with Rob Lowe, to see those quote unquote heartthrobs of the 80s play evil or flip that, just like I like it when the character actor types or the John C. Reilly types get to play good or the protagonist. It's just nice to see some against type casting. And I think Kevin Bacon is so good here. His line delivery on, you know, I am a nice guy, just a different kind of nice guy. The kid gets on my good friend Jed Ayers, who I did the Terrier episode with. His skin, every time I say him watching The River Wild, he's like, I hope they kill the kid this time. Not the actor, of course, but he just hates the kid because he's so bratty. He's terrible. I remember when I saw this with my friends, my friend Chris, who is my fellow film critic at our high school paper. He was actually the editor of the paper. He made the very astute observation. He said, I love how David Strathairn at the beginning of the movie is tripping, getting into the boat. And then at the end, he's like sending up smoke signals and he's turned into an Eagle Scout. I mean, that's, yeah, you know, a lot of fun, but I think it's just a fun thriller. Yeah.
It's an oddly structured movie because Meryl Streep is the protagonist, is the hero. Strathairn actually is the one who has to transform. Yes. And by the third act, it's sort of like, okay, who am I really, like, who's in charge of this story? There's a little bit of, well, maybe there's not. I was about to say there's a little bit of Die Hard, meaning it is about an estranged married couple, like,
finding. No, I think that's a good comparison.
I've never thought about killing the boy. I thought about killing his sister in Jurassic Park, but it's the same. It's the same kid actor, isn't it? Things I noticed or learned about it: Maurice Jarre apparently did the first score for it, which Curtis was very happy with, and somebody Universal wanted gone. And Curtis fought it, lost, and they brought Jerry Goldsmith in to do very quickly to do a replacement score, which was Jerry Goldsmith actually managed that a couple of times. Chinatown is a replacement score.
I can't imagine
modern score. I don't know who did it. I think a Polish composer that Polanski knew, and Bob Evans said, we got to call Jerry. And so Chinatown was written in days, not weeks. I think Air Force One, I think he also had to come in and do it the last minute. And it happened to him once. I think he wrote the score for Ridley Scott's Legend, and they threw that out and replaced it. So it happens. But the point being is, this is what Curtis worked with Jerry Goldsmith on this, who then went on to do his next movie, LA Confidential. I feel like there was some other remarkable insight I had about River Wild. And then I think it does cap off the first half of his career as being a journeyman.
Yeah.
Like solid director, craftsman. And I think in a way the skill he's showing in this movie is like, okay, he's really built up to being a very proficient director, which now allows him to do LA Confidential. Mm-hmm. And I think there's something in the pacing of this movie and in the prior movies, which lends itself to Confidential, which I'm always amazed is LA Confidential could have been a very convoluted movie.
Yes. And yet
it moves like a freight train. It delivers all its information pretty clearly. So you can kind of, you're tracking everything without stopping. And I'm wondering how much I should talk about LA Confidential here, just because it's off.
Oh, go for it.
But especially if you know the book, which I think the book is great fun, but Curtis and Brian Helgeland did an extraordinary job of like ripping stuff out.
Yeah.
Which is one of the reasons why I fear for movies or for storytelling in the era that limited series are taking over from movies.
Yes.
If you make Ally Confidential as a limited series, there's a bunch of stuff that gets stuck in there that is much better gone. The whole Disneyland subplot with Exley's father has a threesome going with Inez Soto, and it's just all sorts of stuff that's like Elroyan but sort of fun to read, but it slows down the train and is also makes things a little, I don't know a better word than ickier.
One thing I like about extremely sordid,
Confidential is that Curtis, who I think is a humanistic filmmaker, even though he makes thrillers, takes the Elroyan characters who can be pretty dark guys, doesn't necessarily whitewash them, but makes them empathetic and
like Vincennes and all of it. Yeah.
Even when they're some of their misogyny, some of their racism.
Yes.
Certainly there are things that are cleaned up where the you know, Elroy didn't use Negroes as a word in his book.
No.
And he certainly, Elroy really luxuriates in the naughtiness and in the impolitic nature of 1950s LAPD.
Yes, I have a story about that, actually.
Hotel.
And then Jordan Harper, when he met Elroy, actually, and Elroy said, so this is going to be at CBS, right? Yes. So at CBS, you can't say, and he went down the list of every word that you couldn't say, but, you know, he said every single word, and nope, we can't say that on CBS. So yes, that's very Elroy.
But there is something, and I think in talking people to people who knew Curtis, he kind of knew, okay, this is my shot. Like it's not that he had been, LA Confidential, the book had only been published in 1990. So he's making this in 96. So it's not like a book that he'd been tracking for a long, long time, but I think he knew that this was an opportunity to make his mark and to elevate things. And that due to the success of Hand the Rock's Cradle and River Wild, that he kind of could go for it here.
That's a good point.
Elswit was not available to shoot it because he had at that point was fallen into PTA land, and
yes, their marriage, so to speak, that ended in divorce a few years back.
I don't know the details of that, and
I'll let
that be either an off post podcast conversation. But Bob Elswit said to me that he thinks that if Curtis had hired him on this movie, that he probably would have gotten fired because they went so far over schedule. And that the studio had more confidence in Dante Spinotti. And I'm going to presume extract that Curtis was sort of pushing the limits of what he could get away with to get this movie the way he wanted it. I'm amazed at the craftsmanship and the skill and the, but I'm also amazed at the political agility, whether it was Curtis, whether it was who else, Arnon Milchan was the producer of it, but everything that allowed him to cast Guy Unknown Pierce,
yes,
Russell
point.
Barely Known Crow, that his big name was Kevin Spacey, who, you know, was an Oscar winner at that point from Usual Suspects, but was not.
Cromwell from Babe.
Or Cromwell. And that Kim Basinger and Danny DeVito were really
the names.
But were, you know, probably fifth and ninth on the call sheet. As far as their characters. So to get the movie made, to get any movie made is some sort of political achievement, but to get this movie made at a studio with those people, and I don't know what the budget of it was, and I do know that it did well. It didn't, you know, break records. It may have been profitable, maybe. It certainly was a critical achievement and won a couple of Oscars and got a little bit dwarfed by the Titanic juggernaut. But I think
Hanson got an Oscar, you know.
Hanson won with Helen for writing. And I think there was sort of a feeling that it was the critic's darling versus Titanic at the time.
Yes.
It was a pretty good year between that and Good Will Hunting and
David Fincher's The Game
Full Monty, I think it was that year.
Boogie Nights, I believe. Yeah.
Same year. Okay. Did I have any other confidential? No, I really had another thing, but I do think it is, I guess to come back to this, that Curtis made Elroy palatable, even for an Elroy fan.
Yes.
It's hard to watch some other Elroy adaptations and enjoy them the way I enjoy L.A. Confidential. These are characters I actually do want to go back and spend time with. And as Curtis says on the commentary, he says, I was focused on characters and their emotions. And that's actually what he does, because the trap, especially for this kind of movie, and not to kick a movie in the shins, but if you've ever seen Mulholland Falls,
I remember that. Nick Nolte.
It's a movie about cigarettes and hats and how everybody looks. And what I love about LA Confidential is like that's all in the background. Everybody looks great. It's done to a T, and that's part of the enjoyment of it, but it's not what the movie's about. And it's not about, again, he doesn't shoot it like a noir. It does. I wouldn't consider it a noir. I just think it's a spectacular movie.
It really is. Yes. I would have loved to have seen what Elswit would have done, but I think Spinotti was perfect for it. This would have been coming off of Heat, which shows his dexterity and his skill with night photography. I'm kind of one of those people who thinks possibly it should have ended at the Victory Motel. So they know you're a policeman as he's approaching the cars. I love that last shot so much that part of me is like, let's stop it here instead of having
talk about that for a second, because I think it's worth it. It's a little bit like Psycho. Like, you could end Psycho with John Gavin defeating Norman Bates.
I agree with you. Yes.
And there's the 10-minute explanation.
Yeah.
I sort of feel like I need it actually
to breathe a little bit.
Telling me what, like, I'm not ready to get up from.
Yeah, so I can
I've
see
never
that.
Had a problem with the exposition scene of Exley. And I think when I run into people who take umbrage to it is the Russell reveal of Bud Smith still being alive, that takes away the daring of shooting him. For one, I think killing Kevin Spacey 2/3 of the way through the movie is plenty daring. And
oh, that was shocking. Yes.
Even knowing the book, I was completely stunned by that. And always sort of next to Marion Crane getting it 45 minutes into Psycho is a great,
Right at the kitchen table. Because I saw this opening night. My whole family went, and for some reason we had to drive really far away to, we were living in Minneapolis, St. Louis Park. So it was a drive just to find it, because this wasn't playing at every single Cineplex. And we went to the late show, and I think we got out around midnight. But yes, I remember that moment, and it was just dead silence. And there were some gasps in the audience when Vincennes gets it. Yeah.
And it's also, if you look back at the rest of his movies, as you said, Bad Influence ends pretty abruptly. Like,
yes.
they kills the kid, the guys walk off, credits. And
immediately. I think it works
in kept script an epilogue, which was like back at a bar, some guys being a beta, and you pan across and like you see Rob Lowe's, or you hear his voice saying something, and it's like, oh, he survived, and here he goes again.
Okay, gotcha.
Silent Partner sort of has a denouement with between Gould and York in the ambulance, but a lot of those movies sort of feel like, all right, we're done, we're out. And because I care about the characters enough in LA Confidential, I'm perfectly fine.
You want to see that? They're going to Arizona.
A little bit of a bow on it. It's not my favorite scene, but some masterpieces aren't perfect.
Yeah, there you go.
Rear Window has a very terrible shot of the helicopters hovering over the bathing beauties, which is like, that's cringeworthy bad. But it's still, I think, one of the best movies ever made. So I will, happily take that if it gives me the rest of the movie.
That's a very good point for sure.
I'm not quite sure what else to talk about. I do have.
Do you have thoughts on his follow-ups? Going into the more character-based work, Wonder Boys is one of my all-time favorite movies.
Talk about that for a bit. Because I didn't review those, but it's all. And I read but did not see Lucky You.
Okay. Lucky You was not great. I loved In Her Shoes. I thought that was a very well-made film. Probably features maybe Cameron Diaz's best performance. It's definitely up there. I liked that one better than the book. He's a filmmaker who likes to take material from books.
His father was an English teacher. I think there is...
Makes sense. Yeah. Yeah. Elizabeth McGovern was the one that recommended he worked with Steve Kloves when it came to Wonder Boys. I love Michael Chabon's work. I think Amazing Adventures of Cavalier Clay is one of the best books ever written. Wonder Boys, however, is not my favorite. I think the film is an improvement on the book. I know I'm going to probably get some pushback on that, but I do believe it. I think it's a movie where you just kind of want to live in it. I'm a fan of films that take place over short time spans. And so this is just one weekend. It's a hangout movie where, you know, they keep having to kind of roll with new problems as they arise. You have very creative, highly intellectual characters who keep making bad decisions, but they have a lot of affection for each other and you have a lot of affection for them. It's just one of my favorite. I watch it every year, usually around my birthday. It is, favorite for sure.
A couple of memories about this, which may lead to our conclusion. I don't know, but
sure.
When I was working with Curtis, I remember it was the Golden Globes that year. Wonder Boys, Bob Dylan was nominated.
Mm-hmm.
And Curtis very sweetly invited me, because he had like 3 tickets to the Golden Globes, to go to the Golden Globes with him.
And nice.
I was living in New York at the time, and like the Saturday that I was supposed to fly out, there was a blizzard.
Oh, no.
JFK shut in, and I just like, I would not be able to get there in time. So I had to tell him and say, I can't make it. And then watching the Golden Globes that night and seeing Curtis, somebody who took my seat, Bob Dylan. And it was like, I could be right. Yeah, it was maddening. All right. So that's memory number one.
This is a therapy session. We're getting it out
thank
there.
You.
Yes.
besides Bud Bedeker and him, Curtis exposing me to him, I do remember having lunch with Curtis once somewhere in Venice, and Robert Wise was at like 2 tables away, and so I got to meet Robert Wise.
Oh wow, yeah.
Before he died, and there is something about Curtis, not certainly in his filmmaking, and in the movies we've discussed, there's a reverence for Hitchcock, but it's also sort of a more broadly a sort of a reverence for a Hollywood studio system. And I think he said that he would have, and I got the sense that he was probably born like a generation too late, that he would have really thrived as prolific sort mm-hmm. of guy that you, who Michael Curtiz, who you just assign a movie and he goes.
Yeah.
And that he would have enjoyed that. That he was not, precious in that sense. And he also both through
wasn't a personality director.
And that not only did he interview all those people with cinema, but I think he threw Sam Fuller passed, he threw a memoriam at the DGA that was apparently pretty fantastic. And he brought a lot of people who'd worked with Fuller back. And he had a very close friendship with Billy Wilder for the last decade of Billy Wilder's life. And so there was, he was a guy who I think really appreciated those who had come before him. He talked a lot about Nicholas Ray's In a Lonely Place and that,
yes,
and that influence on him. And I wouldn't say that there's necessarily a lot of Dixon Steele in Curtis, but maybe like a little bit of, I don't know. I don't know what point I'm making, but whenever I watch that movie, I think of Curtis now, and not because I think he could have been the killer, but it does remind me of him. My other significant memory of Curtis, and maybe this is what we'll end on, is late in life, he had a child, he had a son named Rio, named after Rio Bravo. But before his son was born, and I'm going to guess that Curtis was in his early 60s by this point, I used to hike Runyon Canyon with some friends early in the morning. And this was after my experience with Curtis. So we were friendly, but I felt a little terrible about how it had gone down. And we would quite often pass Curtis on this hike, and he had a backpack, and in that backpack he had weights because he was getting in shape to carry his son around. When I think of Curtis, I like to think of that because he was so excited to be a father that he was doing this preparation, and he was always hiking alone. And then a year later, there Rio was on his back, same hike. And
that's so wonderful.
And not to get maudlin, but I think that is one of the things that I hate about the disease that hit him is he was, I think, really loving being a father, and for him to have that and Rio's off to college in the fall, by the way. To Maine. Good luck, Rio.
Yes, good luck, Rio. Well, Ted, I want to thank you so much for doing this, for sharing your memories and this appreciation of Curtis Hanson. He's long been someone that I've been a fan of and interested in, but I really appreciated you inspiring me to learn more. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me back. I had a blast. Please,
of course.
Call me again. And
anytime. Yes.
I love doing it.
Great. I also want to thank everyone for listening, especially my patrons who support the show and help fund my research equipment, film rentals, RSS fees, and more for as little as a dollar per month at the Film Intuition Patreon, which is the home base for the show. Other ways you can support the podcast are by sharing, reviewing, and subscribing to Watch with Jen wherever you get your podcasts, and also checking out the cool merch store hosted and created by our talented logo designer, Kate Gabrielle. You can find the merchandise store, including shirts, tote bags, stickers, and more by visiting filmintuition.com and clicking on the shop link. The show's theme music is Solo Acoustic Guitar by Jason Shaw and is available in the free music archive. You can also reach me or interact with Watch with Jen anytime on Twitter, either at Film Intuition or our Watch with Jen account as well. Well, until next time, please take care and happy movie watching.
This is Jen Johans at filmintuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen.